sings about the hesitancy to give all of himself to God when there's blood on his hands and his lips aren't clean. His words bring to mind the words of the prophet Isaiah, who denounced unjust leaders, saying, "For your hands are defiled with blood and your fingers with iniquity. Your lips have spoken lies. Your tongue mutters wickedness." If there was ever a biblical character who had blood on his hands and unclean lips, it was Saul. Saul was the most notorious enemy of the church. Flannery O'Connor once said, "I reckon the Lord knew that the only way to make a Christian out of that one was to knock him off his horse." Saul held the coats of those who stoned Stephen, keeping their garments from getting bloody, allowing them to move more freely as they threw rocks at him. Saul was a ringleader in the severe persecution that began against the church in Jerusalem the day that Stephen was murdered. Saul was ravaging the church by entering house after house, dragging people off to prison. He had blood all over his hands. At the beginning of our text for today, we are told that Saul is still breathing threats and murder against the disciples of the Lord. Saul has been endorsed by the high priest to take any followers of Jesus in Damascus to be imprisoned in Jerusalem. He's on his way to Damascus, a city that is 135 miles northeast of Jerusalem. This is a widespread persecution, and Saul will stop at nothing to proclaim death over other people's bodies. On this journey to Damascus, he encounters the Lord. A light from heaven flashes around him, and he falls to the ground. Notice that Saul didn't do anything to bring this experience on himself. God intervenes in Saul's life and literally knocks him down. This is no gradual journey towards change. This man, as Flannery O'Connor says, does get knocked off his horse. God's voice speaks to him, saying those eerie words, "Saul, Saul, why are you persecuting me?" Saul is not just persecuting people whom he hates, but he's persecuting Jesus. Saul doesn't have a clue what his future holds, but he knows that Jesus tells him to get up and enter the city and that he will be told what to do. This man who has been in power, soliciting others to condone his marginalization of Jesus' followers and his murderous acts, now becomes one who listens to what Jesus tells him to do. When he stands up, he realizes that he can't see. So he has to depend on those who are traveling with him to take him to Damascus. For 3 days, Saul is blind. For 3 days, he fasts from food and drink. For 3 bewildering days, he lets this encounter with God sink into reality. Saul's encounter with God is a story of blinding lights and miracles. But what happens next might be even more of a miracle. A disciple named Ananias joins the faithful disciples who've gone before him, not knowing quite what they've gotten themselves into by saying, "Here I am, Lord." And when Ananias hears who he is being called to go to, he protests. Because Saul is well known for his evil acts, and Saul may very well kill him. God responds to Ananias' protest with a proclamation even more alarming. Ananias is being called to go lay hands on this man named Saul and help him regain his sight, because Saul is going to be God's chosen instrument to bring Gentiles into the family of God. Ananias goes and puts his hand on this enemy and calls him brother. At this holy, miraculous moment, something like scales fall from Saul's eyes and his sight is restored. And then, though there was blood on his hands and his lips weren't clean, he received God's grace and was taken to the river and baptized. This murderer follows Jesus into the water and becomes one of the most influential leaders of Christianity. When people hear him preaching about Jesus in the synagogues, they can hardly believe their ears. The poet Tenaya Runyon makes this miraculous moment come alive by imagining what Ananias would have said. She writes, "Saul, you thug who once dragged believers through the streets, flinging them from their beds so hard their arms popped from their sockets, how like a dying child you look. Your stomach caved in from fasting, lips blistered with fervent prayer. You reached into the darkness, trembling from the exhaustion of reliving the scene. The light shot out of the sky. No, it flared from the stones. No, Jesus, your hair was on fire. God spoke to me too, which is why I stand at your bedside now and beseech the Spirit to enter. He loves to appear in the lonely, dank rooms of the faithful. Noah, Mary, Abraham, all sweating out their dreams of God. You will learn how hard belief can be. You will sing while the guards whip you to the bone, touch an enemy's shoulder with grace while the avenging knife burns at your hip. One day you will wish for your sickbed again, this woolen blanket of blindness. But I do as I am told. I lay my fingertips on your lids, and your eyes rumble like stones rolling from the grave. Your lids creak open, and the light burns through. This healing is not easy. Something silver is falling from your eyes. Brother, something like the scales of a struggling fish is scattering at my feet." Because Ananias was willing to participate in the healing and transformation of a murderer, Saul became Paul, who was the leader of the movement to include Gentiles in the family of God. Who in our world needs the blinding light of God to knock them off their horse? Who is breathing threats and murder against God's children? And if God sends us to them, will we be willing to say, "Here I am, Lord"? Will we be willing to confront them even if we don't know how the story will end? As Justo Gonzalez says, when God calls us, rarely are we told more than we need to know at the time. If God gives us a vision of what we are to do, that vision is clarified precisely as we do it. Day by day, step by step, we discover what God desires from us. It is important to remember this, because too often we refuse to respond to God's call until we have clarified every detail and every future step along the way. If those details are not clear, we do nothing. Quite often, hands God can change us and guide us as we work to turn our lives around and make reparations. Some of us need to hear that for ourselves, and some of us need to hear that about others. The most astonishing thing to me in this story is the role Ananias played. He could have ignored God's call to go to Saul. No one would have blamed him. But because he was brave and courageous enough to listen to God's call, many people's lives were changed, not just Saul's. Darryl Davis, a blues musician, was playing music one night at a place called the Silver Dollar Lounge. A white man who was at least 15 years older than him approached him after the set and told him that he really enjoyed his music. And as Davis thanked him and shook his hand, the man said, "You know, this is the first time I ever heard a black man play piano like Jerry Lee Lewis." And Davis responded, "Well, where do you think Jerry Lee Lewis learned how to play this kind of style?" "He learned it from the same place that I did, black, blues, and boogie-woogie piano players." And the man asked Davis to have a drink with him, and as they're sitting and talking together, the white man says, "You know, this is the first time I ever sat down and had a drink with a black man." And Davis is a bit baffled and asks, "Well, how is that? Why?" And the friend sitting next to the white guy elbows him and says, "Tell him. Tell him. Tell him." And the white man finally says, "Well, I'm a member of the Ku Klux Klan." Davis burst out laughing because he doesn't believe it. But then he stops laughing when the guy pulls out his wallet and hands him his Klan card. Now Davis is wondering why in the world he is sitting and having a drink with this man. This conversation was the beginning of a new calling. For Davis to go around the country and to sit down and have conversations with Klan leaders and Klan members, asking them, "How can you hate me when you don't even know me?" Davis, often using music as a conversation to build rapport, forms relationships with these white people. And in these encounters, he says it's not him that converts anybody, but he helps them to see the light that eventually brings about their conversion. Davis even befriended the Grand Dragon Robert Kelly, who was the Imperial Wizard of Maryland. And Kelly eventually shut down his entire chapter. And as kind of a trophy, he gave his robe to Davis. 200 Klansmen have now given Davis their robes. Davis collects the robes and keeps them in his home to remind himself of the dent he has made in racism by simply sitting down and having dinner with people. A woman named Ann Atwater, who surely you remember by now, right? She died in 2016. She was a modern-day Ananias in Durham. Ann was a black woman, a single mother from the poor black part of town, a woman who eventually quit her job working in white people's homes to join the work of the civil rights movement. She befriended a white man named C.P. Ellis, who was the exalted Cyclops, the leader of his local Ku Klux Klan chapter. He was a man who was breathing threats and murder against black people, against God's children, and he was doing it all in the name of Jesus. In the 1960s, Atwater and Ellis were nominated to be the co-chairs of a committee on school desegregation in Durham. Durham had been resisting Brown versus Board of Education's decision, and Atwater and Ellis were named the co-chairs of this committee because they represented both sides of the argument. I'm sure they were both thanking everyone for that. Their story was made into a movie called The Best of Enemies in 2019, but the book that chronicles their story was written by Osha Gray Davidson and originally published in 1996. The fact that Atwater kept engaging with Ellis after all the evil things he said and did is miraculous. She kept leading public conversations with him, and one day Ellis's eyes became descaled. He stood up and publicly tore his KKK membership card into pieces. And Ellis converted that day from being a Klansman, a white supremacist, to being a follower of Jesus. Later in life, Atwater penned a column for the Durham Herald Sun called What Forgiveness Cost. And she talked about choosing to forgive and befriend Ellis. And she wrote, CP showed me that people can learn to love. We really can be born again. But it means leaving the life we've known behind. When we go down to the river to get baptized, we are reminded that we are beloved, made in God's very own image, and we are called to surrender and die to ourselves. But our story today reminds us that in baptism, we can receive God's grace and be transformed. It reminds us that baptism requires us to leave the life we've known behind. It demonstrates that our conversion through baptism also means making reparations for what we've done wrong and living differently. And it means that when those people who we never thought it possible to be converted get converted, those people committed to hate and bigotry and sexism and homophobia and racism and white supremacy, and even those people who just stand there and hold the coats of those who do harm, when those people get converted and start living differently, we must be willing to welcome them as our siblings in the faith. And some of us are called to help those people be transformed. Some of us are called to have courage, to go where God calls us to go, to speak truth, to lay our fingertips on people's eyelids, and to look those who are taken over by evil in the face and grapple with them and help the scales to fall from their eyes. Though there is blood on all of our hands, and our lips aren't clean, we come to the water, just as we are, and trust that God's love and grace can and will break every barrier down. Amen.